This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
First, we are giving opportunity of employment to 250,000 of the unemployed, especially the young men who have dependents, to let them go into forestry and flood prevention work. And in creating this Civilian Conservation Corps, we are killing two birds with one stone. We are clearly enhancing the value of our natural resources, and at the same time, we are relieving an appreciable amount of actual distress. And we are conserving not only our natural resources, but also our human resources.
Hello.
Hello. So what is that then? Is that a mystery voice competition?
That's your great uncle Cyril, isn't it? Tell us about great uncle Cyril.
Well, as you can hear, he's half Dalek.
It was Franklin Roosevelt rather than your uncle Cyril. It was from one of his fireside chats in 1933. And Franklin Roosevelt was the president. He came in during the Great Depression. He basically decided that government shouldn't stand idly by and not do anything to help people and put people back to work. And put people back to work he did, including in the Civilian Conservation Corps, where I think I'm right in saying that 3 million men, and it was men, were put back to work in the great outdoors.
That clip was from Ed's personal collection of FDR's fireside chats. If you're ever lucky enough for Ed to give you a lift somewhere, he doesn't have music playing in his car. He just has those on a loop.
Completely right, as well as sort of back copies of the Labour Party conference. And also, actually the sort of Teach Yourself Italian CD, where I've never really got past the kind of first one, which is C'è una macchina, which we're all very good at saying, but we haven't really got too much past that. Anyway, the relevance of all this is that this week we're talking about youth unemployment and the impact of the crisis on young people. The Resolution Foundation projects that more than 1 million young people could be unemployed by the end of this year in the UK. We know that young people are always hit badly by recessions, but even more so in the current crisis, given young people are more likely to work in the hospitality industry that's shut down and elsewhere. So we're exploring ideas for how to create opportunities for young people as we recover from this crisis. We're going to be looking at the lessons from the past, including the New Deal in America in the 1930s and that Civilian Conservation Corps that I mentioned. We're talking to historian David Woolner about those lessons. Then we're talking to Anna Smee from the Youth Futures Foundation and Kathleen Hennehan from the Resolution Foundation. We'll be asking them how government can address the problems of youth unemployment today. Then finally, we're looking at a really exciting idea for a youth environment service, which could both address unemployment and help tackle the climate emergency. And we're talking to Martin Moore from King's College London.
That all sounds good. Do you want to tell us about your reason to be cheerful this week? Have you found much cheer in the past 7 days?
You know, I've got quite into the animal memes in this period, and my son Daniel is turning 11 on the 2nd of June, and I think we've got, I wouldn't say it's the perfect present, but basically you can do a Zoom call with a goat for hire. And so we thought we'd have that, do that on his birthday as a little family thing. And basically you can find out all about the goat's personalities. There's Mary, ambivalence, limited attention span, totally fine, peeing in front of you. I think Cuthbert is who Justine's got her eye on. Cuthbert, young Cuthbert, is the son of Shaking Susan, a naturally inquisitive fellow. Cuthbert likes to talk space exploration and what goat farming might look like on Mars. Excellent goat sci-fi knowledge, and interest in all things space, travel, camera, headbutting. Anyway, basically, I think this is a farm that's obviously, you know, facing some difficulties as a result of coronavirus, and they've been relatively inventive, and you can get to spend time with a goat. You can also hire a goat if you've got a business meeting and you want the goat on your Zoom call as well.
This is fantastic, especially if you've got a difficult business meeting where maybe you've got some disappointing sales figures to show or something. They call it the dead cat strategy, don't they, where you put something onto the table that is such a distraction that nobody talks about what was going on in the meeting already, and that's now used as a political technique. This is far better, the live goat strategy.
Very good. The live goat strategy replaces the dead cat strategy. I mean,
yeah, far more positive, far more on brand.
Linton Crosby, look out, Jeff Lloyd is coming to eat your lunch.
But not your goat.
But hopefully not your goat, otherwise it would no longer be the live goat. What's your reason to be cheerful?
My reason to be cheerful is, so obviously my son's not at nursery at the moment, so I'm spending more time with him even than I usually do, which means more screen time than we usually allow him. And I found this great thing on CBeebies called Nick Cope's Popcast, where a friendly fella, probably of a similar age to us, comes on and kids call in via video phone. It's all set up, but they sort of call in via video phone and give him a subject, and he writes a song on that subject, and they do a lovely animation, and it's just really lovely preschool children's television. But I thought, this guy looks, he's just got the look of somebody who in a former life would have been some kind of pop star or in a band. So I googled him, and he was in a band called the Candy Skins. Do you remember them?
I got to say, I sort of preferred their early stuff before they, you know, had those artistic tensions.
Well, they were from Oxford, and I'm guessing they came up in the late 80s when you would have been at university there. So you were probably down the front in the mosh pit, if there ever was a mosh pit at Candy Skins gigs. And yeah, he was the guy from that band who I always enjoyed back in the day. And not only that, he comes from a show business family. His dad played Hopkirk in Randall and Hopkirk Deceased.
Wow.
Now I've piqued your interest.
Yeah, that's definitely a reason to be cheerful. Can I ask you a question in this context of our children, which is it okay to be economical with the truth about the Tooth Fairy? The reason I ask is that Daniel, who's 10, lost a tooth. I don't think he told us. He put the tooth under the pillow, and of course nothing happened. But I've got to make a confession that I've gone to increasingly elaborate methods to try and keep the mythology of the Tooth Fairy going, including sort of saying that there's a free phone number where you've got to like ring in to say that there's been a tooth falling out and that there's been problems to do with, you know, the current sort of lockdown and crisis for the Tooth Fairy.
Exactly. I mean, that's it. The Tooth Fairy's in lockdown. They're not considered a key worker. So that's
but
why.
Do you think that's an okay? Do you think? But what's the sort of balance of what's the balance of kind of what's allowed and what's
oh,
the
I
right
think
age?
It's fine. I think people overthink this stuff. I think firstly he is testing a little bit anyway by not telling you, so he's figuring it out himself. But secondly, I think don't get too hung up about it, because you know it's a good lesson to learn about life, that life is just full of lies and disappointments anyway, isn't it?
I mean, how would it be? Bear with me here. How would you feel if I said that I'd written a sort of an article which purported to be from The Guardian by Terry McCavity and Bob Filling about the crisis that the Tooth Fairy was facing in order to sort of make it kind of credible? Would that be all right?
Yeah, I think we'd all like to read that article. Can we put it in the newsletter?
I'm not sure you could. Maybe Joel can. The problem is that I kind of was in this sort of two minds about whether I was pretending it was true or sort of just having a joke. So I left in Terry McCavity and Bob Filling. They then Googled Bob Filling, and of course Bob Filling doesn't sort of exist. So it's sort of stretching it's stretching credibility. I felt like I needed a bit of a sort of raised eyebrow in it. I think the truth is that they want to carry on believing in it because they're worried about the sort of flow of fun stopping when they stop believing in it. And so it's sort of slightly playing along with us.
I think it's fine. And I think if we ever need a week off, what are they called? Bob McCavity and
Terry McCavity and Bob Filling.
Terry McCavity and Bob Filling. They can stand in for us.
Yeah.
You're listening to Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
So we're going to start by talking to David Woolner, who is a professor of history at Marist College in New York. He is resident historian at the Roosevelt Institute and author of The Last 100 Days, FDR at War and at Peace. David, hello.
Hi. Great to speak with you, Jeff, and you as well, Ed.
Where do we find you socially distancing?
I'm in a place called Rhinebeck, New York, which is a nice little village on the Hudson River about 100 miles north of New York City. So not a bad part of the world to be in right now.
It could be worse. So we started the podcast today by playing a clip of FDR setting out some of the great plans from the New Deal. I wondered if you could just help us by just explaining the background to the New Deal, both in general and then, you know, we can come on to what it was in relation to the problems of young people. But can you tell us about, you know, how it, the circumstances which led to it and what the basics of it were?
Well, of course, by the time Roosevelt took office in March of 1933, the United States was in the midst of the worst economic crisis of its history, right? Unemployment nationwide was running at 25%, but in cities like Detroit and Chicago, it was as high as 40 or 50%. And of course, when Roosevelt took office, there was no real experience in the United States with the state intervening in the economy. I mean, the only real contact the American people had with the government was when they went to the post office. There was no Social Security, there was no unemployment insurance, there was no federal deposit insurance in the banks, very little regulation of the stock market, the financial sector, etc. So it really was kind of unfettered capitalism, and you were very much on your own. And the size of the crisis just completely overwhelmed any notion of people finding relief from private charity and so forth. So, you know, facing this in the Democratic convention in the summer of 1932, Roosevelt made this famous pledge to give the American people a New Deal. And the New Deal really represents this whole series of programs and reforms that Roosevelt put in place during the 1930s.
And it was, you know, a terrible time for everybody. But can you talk to us specifically about how young people and their prospects were affected?
Well, for young people, the Great Depression was particularly hard. And in terms of unemployment, for youth between the ages of 16 and 24, unemployment was actually higher for them than it was for the national average. It was more like 30%. So they were really devastated by the Great Depression. And both Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt were, you know, really terrified that they would be losing a whole generation of young people.
So what did the New Deal do specifically to address those concerns in youth unemployment?
Well, one of the things, one of the most famous programs and actually one of the most popular programs was the establishment of what was called the Civilian Conservation Corps. You know, many of these ideas actually Roosevelt tested out when he was governor of the state of New York from 1928 to 1932. Roosevelt loved nature. He lived in this beautiful estate on the Hudson River, overlooking the Hudson and the Catskill Mountains in the distance. He liked to call himself Forester in Chief because he was a great believer in conservation and planting trees. And so, you know, when we think of the Civilian Conservation Corps, we think of this reforestation program. After 100 years of unregulated timber harvesting, you know, the United States forests were decimated. So Roosevelt had this idea that he would recruit young men in the cities who, again, concerned about idleness, concerned about the damaging effects of people not being able to work, and take them out into the countryside. You know, Roosevelt was a great believer in the restorative qualities of nature. So this idea, and this is very typical of the New Deal, when we think of the CCC, we think of this environmental program. It's like the first Green Jobs program. Right, you're going to reforest America. But it was much more than that. It was also an urban relief program. The CCCers got paid $25 or $30 a month, but they had to send $25 a home to their families. Many of these young men were uneducated. So they discovered, well, they need an education. Many of them couldn't read or write properly. So they built school rooms, and then they hired teachers, and they would have classes in the evenings. They had hearty meals. The average CCCer put on 12 pounds of weight during the course of their tenure. So over 3 million young men served in the Civilian Conservation Corps. And by the time it ended in 1943, it was one of the most popular programs of the entire New Deal.
What was the National Youth Administration?
Well, that was the second major program that Roosevelt initiated. This he executed by executive order in 1935. It was under the auspices of the WPA.
The Works Progress Administration, sorry, just for our listeners.
The Works Progress Administration. One of the things that that they tried to do was to keep young people in school. You know, if unemployment is high, you don't want young people entering the workforce. So they put in place a program of assistance, a kind of work-study program. Again, no one had ever done this before. hiring young people to work in school offices and cafeterias, do maintenance work, janitorial work, both in high school and in college, so they could stay in school and finish their education. And by 1937, over 400,000 young people were receiving assistance through the NYA educational programs. But then, of course, there were also young people who were not in school, who were needing to work. Many of them were unskilled, of course, because they hadn't acquired a skill yet. So they had to put together job training programs, job placement agencies, and get started on trying to get them into gainful employment. All of these programs, by the way, were locally administered, so local communities could try to figure out what was the most useful work that could be done for them. And in 1939, Roosevelt really solved this problem of youth unemployment in terms of skills by suggesting that they train them as machinists and skilled industrial workers to work in the burgeoning defense industry. So they started recruiting people in 1939 nationwide. They put a big emphasis on African Americans and women, bringing them into the mainstream industrial workforce. And so when we get to the Second World War, literally hundreds of thousands of machinists and NYA-trained workers were helping turn the United States into what FDR called the Great Arsenal of Democracy.
Let me just pick up on some of those points. So I was quite struck that you said the Civilian Conservation Corps, 3 million men. Was it only for men? It sounds like some of the programs were then extended. And just say a little bit more, David, about what they were doing. What was the range of activity?
Right. It was an urban program for men. They also enrolled African-American men and Caucasian men. So it had a multi-racial component. In fact, originally the programs were segregated, but then they started integrating them, particularly in the North. So that was a step forward. You know, as I said, with this terrible unemployment, they wanted to get people to work as soon as possible. You know, Roosevelt was a great believer in the dignity of work. He wanted people to be given that dignity. So they would go out and they would have to build their own camps. They would build roads into the areas that they were working. They were involved in wildlife protection. They were involved in the restoration of historic sites and parks, in the development of national parks. And, you know, if we take the totality of the Roosevelt years, and let's not forget, much like global warming today, Roosevelt also faced an environmental catastrophe in the Dust Bowl of the 1930s, which was absolutely devastating to the farmers in the Midwest. People were literally dying of what they called Dust Bowl pneumonia, the lungs filling with dust.
Caused by drought.
Caused by drought and caused by over plowing, by poor farming techniques during the First World War and the economic boom of the 20s. So how do you stop that? And they planted over 218 million trees from Texas Panhandle to the Canadian border, over 18,000 miles of shelter belts. And it worked. It's extraordinary. It worked.
So you would judge these programs a success, I assume, from what you're saying.
Absolutely. Absolutely a success. And if you talk, I mean, most of them have died now. I don't think there are any CCCers alive or people that worked in the National Youth Administration. But their memories of this program were extraordinary. I mean, they felt it was a lifesaver and a life changer for them. And the other thing that's interesting is, you know, for example, in the National Youth Administration, they set up an Office of Minority Affairs. Run by a black woman, Mary McLeod Bethune. I mean, that was just unprecedented to bring young African-American men and women into the National Youth Administration.
And this was a massive shift in attitude to the role of government compared to what had gone before. I know that's a sort of really basic and important thing about the New Deal, but I think it's just worth emphasizing.
Absolutely. As I said earlier, you know, there really was no precedent for government intervention in the economy. And so what Roosevelt was facing was, you know, how do you make capitalism work for the average American? You know, what do you do? How do you mitigate the worst excesses of unfettered capitalism? So it's just one thing after another, an enormous amount of creative energy that really transformed the relationship between the American people and their government. That's really the key.
Now, of course, David, we're not just talking to you as a piece of interesting history, because very sadly, and probably in a way that you couldn't have envisaged, and nor could I, the experience of what happened in the 30s with Roosevelt is obviously speaks to this very difficult moment that we're in. I think I'm right in saying that we now have 36 million Americans out of work, 7 million young people out of work. Talk to us about the lessons of the New Deal and in particular Civilian Conservation Corps today, not just for the United States, but for us here too.
Well, you know, I think I'm safe in saying that both the United States and Great Britain suffer from a certain lack of maintenance of infrastructure, physical infrastructure. So when you look at the WPA, almost 600,000 miles of highway, right? 122,000 bridges, 8,000 airports. I mean, it goes on and on and on. As I said, no one had ever really done this before in the United States. So this was this active use of government. When Roosevelt gave his first inaugural address, he's famous for the line, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself." But the reality is that the line that got the biggest applause during the course of that address was, "This nation is calling for action and action now." So for young people today, I mean, we are facing an environmental challenge of unprecedented proportions. There's tremendous need for innovation in the energy sector and green jobs programs. And I think if Roosevelt were around today, he would look at this as kind of holistically and say, we need, you know, again, we need to marshal the resources of the nation to meet these challenges.
And David, obviously that leads me on to the question, which is, what do you make of the calls in the U.S. and in the U.K. but particularly about the U.S. For a Green New Deal?
I think Roosevelt would very much support the idea of the Green New Deal. And it's very similar to the philosophy behind the New Deal. As I said, these programs were multifaceted. The CCC providing not only reforestation and environmental programs, but urban relief and education. So there's this deeper thinking going behind the use of government intervention in the economy that I think current political leaders tend to lack. You know, simply providing unemployment insurance is really not enough. I think people should think more deeply about where can we stimulate the economy in ways that will bring a better future for this young generation that's facing this enormous economic challenge.
Well, David Woolnough, it's really inspiring to talk to you about what Roosevelt did sort of massively ahead of his time and relevant today. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ed. It's been my pleasure and great seeing you.
To talk about the challenge we face in terms of youth unemployment, we're joined now by Anna Smee, who's Chief Executive of the Youth Futures Foundation, which was established last year to tackle youth unemployment in England, and Kathleen Hennehan, who's Research and Policy Analyst at the Resolution Foundation. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hello, thank you.
Anna, let's start with you. Your organisation had only recently been set up when the crisis began. What is the Youth Futures Foundation and what's the story behind it?
That's right. Yeah, we were set up with a £90 million endowment from Dormant Assets, which is the money that some of us might have left behind in bank accounts over the years. So if you've ever abandoned a few pounds in a bank account when you switched, then eventually it gets handed over to the Reclaim Fund and then they give it to charitable purposes, one of which is to support young people. So we were set up to get young people who face discrimination or disadvantage into work.
Obviously, you were set up before the crisis, but we know, and Kathleen will talk to this, we know how serious the situation now is. What does it look like from your perspective?
Yes, that's right. We already knew there were 750,000 young people outside of training and work before COVID hit. And now we estimate there's probably at least 600,000 further young people will find themselves out of work this year. And as you say, I'm sure Kathleen can talk much more about that. We're particularly worried that young people are already saying to us that they're being furloughed or made redundant at a higher rate than other age groups. And the prospects for them don't look fantastic because many of them work in service industries, hospitality, retail, which have been especially hard hit. And job centres tend to be really equipped to get people back into jobs in those sectors as well. So there's going to be a double whammy here where there's a drop in demand and an increase in young people looking for jobs.
So, Kathleen, a lot of expectation here on you. What does your research at the Resolution Foundation show about the impact that the current crisis is having on young people's job prospects?
As I think, as Anna rightly pointed out, from a big picture lens, it's really quite worrying. So our research focused on 18 to 24 year olds, and we found that, you know, over the coming months, we can expect the number of unemployed 18 to 24 year olds to more than double. It will, in all likelihood, exceed well over 1 million, which is something that we really haven't seen since the 1980s. And I think, as Anna pointed out, you know, a big reason for this is because young people, and particularly non-graduates, tend to get their start in these sectors like hospitality, retail, arts and recreation, that have been so badly hit currently, and actually we don't really expect to recover anytime soon.
And do you expect non-graduates then, from what you're saying, to take a much bigger hit than graduates?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's worth saying that, you know, we expect all young people to be hit by this. But when we look at what happened in the last crisis, you tended to see graduates shuffle into those jobs that non-graduates typically would have taken. So, you know, your hospitality retail roles, and non-grads were a bit more left out in the lurch. Now that those sectors are really struggling, everyone will be, you know, left worse off. But we probably expect that when vacancies do start to open up again, employers are probably going to be biased towards those with higher level qualifications.
Just to be clear about this, the problem we've got is not just the problem you might get in a recession we've had before, which is people being made redundant. It's you've got a problem of outflow from unemployment, haven't you? You've got a problem that there just aren't the vacancies. Talk a little bit to that, Kathleen.
Yeah, so we've seen a huge fall in vacancies. And one of the things that's really worrying is that we've already had a huge number of people, as Anna said, 750,000 young people who are unemployed. And there's nowhere there. Well, in terms of inflows, there is nowhere for them to flow into at the moment. And obviously that will hit non-graduates particularly hard.
What's the scale of that, Kathleen, the fall in the vacancies, or is there a measure of that?
Yeah, so I think in terms of the flow of new vacancies coming onto the market, it was down, I think, 80% as of 2 weeks ago, and that's across the board.
Right.
Some of the research that Resolution Foundation just published went and looked back at actually change in total vacancies, not the inflow of vacancies, across sectors. And what you tend to see is that, you know, obviously it was those hospitality retail roles that fell by nearly 100%. And obviously, to a lesser extent, we saw that in sort of professional, scientific and technical roles. But, you know, the crux of the issue is really in those sort of lower qualification type industries.
And can you remind us what happened in 2008 with regards to young people's job prospects? You mentioned there graduates taking jobs that were typically done by non-graduates. What else happened, and what are the similarities and perhaps differences to today?
Yeah, so one of the things that we've really been concerned about is unemployment in the here and now for young people, and then actually how that affects people for years to come. So last time round, unemployment rose amongst grads and non-grads, but actually the scale of that rise was a lot larger for non-graduates. And actually, even as many as 3 years after they left full-time education, the unemployment rate for non-grads was about 17%. Now, if you compare that with people who left education during better times, so we focus on 2013, the unemployment rate at that same period of time after having left education was 11%. Now, when we compare different cohorts of graduates, there is a little bit of a difference in employment rates, in unemployment rates, but it's much smaller. And obviously that affects pay too, because if you don't get onto that career ladder than you would have otherwise expected to, you're probably going to go into a lower paid role than you would have done absent a crisis. And so we actually see that, you know, their levels of pay were a lot lower for people who graduated, you know, in the midst of a crisis than those who left.
So this is when people talk about long-term scarring. This is what that means.
Yeah. It's not the here and now. It's how it affects you for years to come.
Does it affect you for your whole career?
Yeah, so this is one of the things that is actually really worrying. So for those 2009 non-grads, they still, even 6 years after having left education, they still have a higher unemployment rate than people 6 years after having left education who graduated in 2013. In terms of what we'd expect through pay, it affects both non-grads and graduates for at least, you know, 4 to 5 years. So in terms of your lifetime earnings, then it very well could have an effect over a person's life.
So we have an idea of how it will likely affect graduates and non-graduates. What about different variations within young people, social groups and so on?
Yes, we can already see that it's going to impact young people in different regions of the UK very differently, I think. The unemployment data that came out from ONS last week, which shows the biggest spike in unemployment since the 1940s, showed that it was a dramatically bigger impact, for example, in the north of England and the Midlands than in the southeast. And I think there's also an element of, you know, which regions have been hit hardest by COVID and how confident people therefore feel going back to work in a job where they have to actually be physically present, like warehousing, delivery drivers, etc. There's also a big variation between those young people that might have a reason why they can't get back to work, for example, issues around immunity, young people who've got illnesses or disabilities that make them much more vulnerable and would therefore find it difficult to go back.
So this is a sense of the scale of the problem and the dangers of not acting. Anna, talk to us now about what you are advocating at the Youth Futures Foundation for what government should be doing.
Yeah, we are very keen for government, obviously, to see this as a number one priority. So first and foremost, we'd like them to be unlocking funding. And we think it should be a cross-government initiative. So it's not just about Department for Work and Pensions. We need them to be working hand in hand with the Department for Education. You know, 50% of the young people leaving year 13 this year will expect to go straight into a job under normal circumstances, not to go on to higher education. And they're going to leave without having completed the academic year and without having any career advice available to them. So that's crucial. We need government to recognise that young people need support for the whole journey. So this isn't just a question of them arriving at a Job Centre Plus and being signposted towards, you know, an opportunity. Many of these young people will actually need a bit more help than that to understand what they're trying to achieve in their career, to make sure that they start in the right kind of job, that they understand career progression opportunities, and that they stick in that job as well, that they don't bounce out of it within a few weeks. Otherwise, that can be very challenging.
And talk to us about what the Labour government did in 2008, Anna, which was the Future Jobs Fund, and sort of how successful that was, what we can learn from it, what we could do better.
Yeah, so the Future Jobs Fund was very successful, actually. It's one of the few big initiatives that's been properly evaluated in a meaningful way using randomised controlled trials and evidence to work. In particular, it supported young people into either volunteering or a job and ensured that if they'd been unemployed for 9 months, there was a guaranteed place for them. And the reason that it was effective was because it was quite personalised. There was an element of choice for those young people, and they received support to select an appropriate pathway for them. There was some wage subsidy as part of it. So if they took a job, those jobs were often subsidised, so the employer could take the young person on for a lower cost than normal. But then they were encouraged to retain that young person longer term without that subsidy. And again, there's a lot of good evidence to suggest that wage subsidies, as a general rule, are an effective approach. Personalised support is a very effective approach.
And Anna, do you think we should be guaranteeing young people jobs, given what Kathleen's warned us about in terms of the long-term scarring effects?
At Youth Futures Foundation, we think that a jobs guarantee for young people who've been out of work for 6 months is really important. That provides the opportunity for them to have presented as being out of work and received additional support initially to help find a job themselves. Most people manage to find work within 13 weeks. So actually, for a lot of people, that will be sufficient. But given the exceptional circumstances we're in and the barriers that many young people face, for those that are still out of work after 6 months, it's important then to take stronger action.
Talk to us about one part of this, which I'm quite keen on, which is the role of the kind of environmental side as part of this Future Jobs Fund. I mean, it strikes me that there is a massive amount to be done as the country transitions to net zero emissions. We've got to do that work. How much of a role can that play?
Yes, I mean, that's a really interesting area to explore. I think there is the short-term and the long-term aspect to this. So in the immediate term, obviously, the areas where we most need young people to take up work actually are in agriculture and in health and social care. But in the longer term, exactly as you're describing, looking for jobs that enable us to transition to a more sustainable future would be fantastic.
Talk a bit more about agriculture and health and social care.
So at the moment, obviously, because of COVID and longer term as well, because of changes to immigration policy, it's going to be challenging to get enough staff to be out there picking fruit and vegetables. And it also feels like a really fantastic opportunity for many of our young people. You know, lots of them would like to, ideally, to go abroad, do a gap year, have a chance to kind of build their skills and socialise before they go off to university or get a permanent job. So I think there might be a chance there to look for a big programme and a way of connecting those young people. But it's going to take some careful planning and thought about social distancing and young people being able to travel away from home and how we would accommodate them.
Kathleen, something you're keen on is government supporting young people to stay in education. Can you explain how this helps and what exactly you'd like to see government doing?
Yeah, absolutely. We've sort of thought about policy in two ways, you know, policy to help young people stay on for next year and policy to help those who inevitably will be entering the jobs market. But in terms of helping people stay on in education, I think we know that a large proportion of today's leavers are going to leave with lower level qualifications, and that even in the best of times, they'll struggle to find meaningful work and to progress in that work. So rather than them sort of exit into unemployment in an activity, we think it's a really great time for government to consider proposals that will allow them to sort of stay on in full-time study. So for instance, the Association of Colleges are talking about a September promise. That means that every person who wants to stay on in education can have a place to do so. And, you know, this benefits young people in a number of ways. Like, you know, just obviously benefits their skills, their human capital, and it makes sure that they'll be more productive people when they do enter the workforce. But also, you know, the opportunity cost to studying, while there are so few vacancies and such little odds of them finding work, obviously much lower right now. So we think it's a really good time for people to do so. But obviously there are a lot of barriers to that, and particularly for those people who want to study in further education colleges, which, you know, tend to offer less in terms of maintenance support that will allow them to study and work full time.
Something we were wondering about is we've seen universities say that they're going to do tuition online, and yet they're still charging the full tuition fees. Do you think that is going to have an effect on whether young people choose to go to university?
Yes, I think there is a risk of that. I imagine for a lot of young people who are taking on significant debt to go to university, it's going to make them stop and think twice. I think it would be really important from an economy point of view that they don't do that. They do take up their place at university and therefore don't find themselves out of work at a really challenging time because of all the scarring effects that Kathleen's talked about. But there is a reality that that is a big investment for many young people, particularly those from low-income backgrounds, and that may not be the decision that they make.
We do have a big worry that that young people might look at the opportunities that are afforded to them in terms of studying with their colleagues and having one-to-one tuition and be nervous about taking up their place. Another big group of young people that we might worry about is graduates who otherwise would go on to take a master's degree, particularly in times of crisis. And obviously, you know, this isn't the most desperate group of young people. They tend to be better off on average. But in the last crisis, we did see a sharp rise in the number of young people staying on in education for one more year after they've graduated university. And we would have, under normal expectations, you know, expected to see that again. But given changes to how lectures are going to look like next year, it's very unclear that they will do so.
Kathleen, we talked earlier about some of the scarring effects of not acting on this. Talk to us about the positive effects of acting, both not just for the young people themselves, but for our economy and society as a whole. And that's really a question to both of you, actually.
This has garnered huge amounts of attention on the need to actually allow some young people to stay on in education more, and the need to help those who have, you know, been out of work for some time, and the greater number of people we expect to see in that position. So I think from our perspective, just the fact that people are talking about this, and we have policymakers say, should we have maintenance loans for kids who want to study in further education? Should we have a jobs guarantee? That narrative taking hold is really positive for young people's future employment prospects.
And Anna?
I think that's really true. I think opening opportunities for young people in new sectors that they wouldn't have been able to access before, and simplifying pathways into training and work would be a huge benefit.
Okay, Anna Smee, Kathleen Hannan, it's clearly a massive challenge, but you've given us some, I think, reasons for optimism. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Cheers.
And we're going to speak now to Martin Moore, who is Director of the Centre for the Study of Media, Communication and Power at King's College in London. But more excitingly for us today, he is a man with an idea, which is a potential reason to be cheerful.
He's a man of many parts. I mean, I know Martin, but I mean, he's obviously, you know, he's Renaissance man, really.
A polymath.
A polymath, that's right.
Are you blushing, Martin?
I'm certainly blushing because I'm feeling very overextended right now, because I'm talking about something which is something it's an idea that I've had which takes me a long way from my usual field of expertise.
But you've got good bookcase credibility, so that must count for something.
Well, thank you.
Ed is just saying this because he's looking at your bookcase on this Zoom call and he's spotting a lot of books that he owns. That's how you're judging.
Exactly. Exactly.
So tell us about the idea. It's a youth environment service.
Yes, it's called the Youth Environment Service. It's an idea that's based on national service, but instead of being focused on defence and security, it's focused on the environment. So the idea is that every 18 to 25-year-old or around that age would have an opportunity to spend a year working on an environment project for the purposes of addressing or at least slowing some of the climate crisis we're going through, making the country more resilient to floods, to fires, hurricanes, and of course pandemics, and to trying to make our way of life more sustainable in the long term. And hopefully will also mean that we kind of raise the whole understanding and awareness of the problems, but also practical ways to deal with them around the whole population.
And what would those practical ways look like in terms of what work would the young people be doing?
So I think, you know, again, when I thought about this, there were five kind of big areas that I thought people could contribute. But certainly this would need to be adapted given the coronavirus crisis, because everything has to change, I suppose. But I mean, the five areas that I was thinking of were around, one was around protecting. So it was around ways to protect against environmental degradation and damage, whether it's building flood defences, whether it's building protection against fires, and whether it's just, you know, insulating homes around the country to make homes more sustainable. The second was about restoring. So it was about restoring lands and waterways, and removing plastic from the seas. It was about restoring brownfield sites to increase sustainability. The third was exploring, which was to fund enough technological and scientific research to specifically to address some of the practical problems of climate change. A fourth was around sustaining, which is planting trees, growing food, creating sustainable systems. And then a fifth one was about supporting those who have already been hurt or damaged by climate change. So, for example, by the recent floods or otherwise.
We're talking on this episode about youth jobs and youth unemployment, and your idea is certainly something that speaks to me. The slightly peculiar thing, as we referred to at the beginning, is you usually study media and reform of the media, and you and I have worked together on this in the past. How did you get into this?
Very good question. I mean, I come to this really as just someone who's very anxious about it. As you say, I normally teach media and politics and do research around that. But I was invited last year to join a whole series of conversations which were organized by an American foundation called the Berggruen Institute. And they'd gathered together a really very interesting and eclectic bunch of people, academics and politicians and philosophers and writers, and to try to think about many of the big problems that we're facing society, and particularly democratic societies, and how to address them. And then a few people started discussing the benefits of national service and conscription and for the purposes of things like social cohesion and dealing with polarization and dealing with some of the issues of inequality. And that was when I kind of, I suppose, a bit of a light bulb went off and I thought, well, hang on a minute. You know, it doesn't, for me at least, it doesn't make sense to try and recreate national service in the way it worked in the 20th century. But actually, if you rethink it for the 21st century and you rethink it in terms of the environment, then suddenly actually it both achieves those goals, but it, you know, starts to hopefully address the much bigger goal, which is about, it's about the climate emergency.
And just to be clear about this, you're not saying this is an obligatory program. I mean, you're seeing it as a voluntary program.
It's for different countries to decide. So quite a lot of democracies already have national service or conscription. So you know, Switzerland, Brazil, South Korea, Israel. So countries that already have that might want to adapt aspects of their national service, their conscription for that. But other countries where there is no national conscription almost certainly would want to do it in terms of a voluntary basis. But I think the key is that the opportunity is open to all young people. I think this has to be necessarily a very broad program and include everyone in it.
Have you had much pickup on this proposal?
Well, I mean, one of the fortunate things, I guess, about where I had the idea was that a lot of the people there were connected to different walks of life. And so some of them who were interested started already having conversations with, and it was a very international crowd too. So they started having conversations with various people in different countries. As I understand it, there have been some conversations with international institutions like the UN who appear interested in it and are talking about it. Since the coronavirus started, one of the things that's been striking is that a number of people have started talking about the idea of national service or conscription, or there are some moments where maybe an idea's time has come and many people have a similar idea at a similar time. And my hope is that it snowballs, and it really takes off. But I'd love other people to get interested in the idea and to sort of collaborate and to try and work it up and to try and create something from this, because if there was ever a moment for it, it seems like it was now.
Well, that's a good moment to end on. Martin Moore, polymath, bookcase credibility, media expert. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much indeed.
So what did you think?
Well, obviously, the prospect of youth unemployment on the scale we're talking about is terrifying. But that being said, I found some real reason to be cheerful in there. I loved hearing about the New Deal, which, I know some aspects of the history of the New Deal. But what particularly struck me on that was just how far it was from what the American state was typically doing at that point. Just you think of America being a much more small state country than European countries, but just that in that context, FDR was able to do that was incredibly inspiring. When you think about, you know, we've lived with these years of austerity, and you can maybe look at the current government and say, but are they going to do anything radical? Well, they could. It's there. Even the response to the coronavirus crisis has shown, as we talked about in previous episodes, you know, in a crisis, you can make these bold choices. So I thought there was some cause for optimism there.
And I agree that it was so inspiring to hear from David. And just, you know, one knows about FDR, at least I know about FDR in a sort of theoretical sense, but just being reminded, you know, 3 million, albeit that it was men, but, you know, 3 million men, you know, in that civilian conservation corps, you know, 218 million trees, you know, that is, it's just the scale of ambition. And I actually think the biggest thing I take out of all four of our guests is sort of the emergency and the scale of ambition required.
Reasons to be cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Well, as ever, we would love to hear from you. If you've got any thoughts on this week's episode or ideas for future episodes, you can go to our website, cheerfulpodcast.com, which will give you all the ways to get in touch, and you can sign up for our newsletter on there too.
I love our newsletter. Sign up for our newsletter. If you need to hear more about the Tooth Fairy, sign up.
This comes from Frida, who says, "Many greetings from my parents' house in the rural southwest of Germany, where I have been stuck for almost 3 months now. Earlier this year, our family dog, Charlie, died, whom we had for more than 15 years.
Oh, how sad.
It is sad. I'm sorry. R.I.P. Charlie. He was a good boy. Now, since the lockdown, my brother and I have both been stranded at home, and we've desperately tried to convince our parents to get another dog. But since we're both living somewhere else, they weren't giving in. We have no good arguments, really, except that life without a dog is pointless. But thanks to you, Ed, we have now got an imaginary dog called Chutney.
Fantastic!
Chutney's had a baby.
Immaculate conception. We're breeding Chutneys all over the place.
Chutney puppies.
Yeah.
Frida says, my mum and I went for a run with him earlier.
Or mangoes. Mangoes, as they're known. Yeah.
And my dad is telling us kids off when we're trying to feed him at the dinner table.
Oh,
our neighbours must think we've completely lost it. Anyway, I just wanted to thank Ed for this idea.
Honestly, that's Jeff, that is heartwarming news. That is heartwarming news. And more heartwarming news comes from Debbie Scholes. His subject line is fundamentally good. I just wanted to let you know about a heartwarming story. We love those. I was listening to the latest podcast about people being fundamentally good when I was walking my dog this evening. Now, you've got to bear with us here because it's quite convoluted, this story.
Real dog or an imaginary dog?
I think it's a real dog. We live in Australia and she found, this is the dog, a rainbow lorikeet on the ground, which is not their behaviour when they're healthy, so I knew something was wrong. I tied up my, brackets, real dog and ran off to a nearby house to ask if I could borrow a towel to rescue the bird. The people at the house got me a towel and asked if there was anything else they could do. And just as I was leaving again, my real dog, Nala, arrived. She had slipped her collar and come to find me. Another man who was walking his own dogs, also real, I think, checked if she was mine. He had seen her loose and kept an eye on her. The man from the house where they left me the towel followed me back to Nala's collar and led me to make sure we were okay. Then after rescuing the bird and asking for advice on a local Facebook group about what to do next, a few people told me what to do and one offered to take care of the bird, which is also real, overnight if I needed them too. So I encountered several kind and helpful people during the course of one podcast about how people are fundamentally good. And she's got a lovely emoji of the bird. The bird is currently safe and cozy in a box and will be alive and will be collected in the morning.
Fantastic. Rutger Bregman would be proud of you.
That's
all.
That's a great story, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Totally.
And just very quickly, this from Twitter comes from Hermione, who says, the GP I just spoke to about my UTI sounded exactly like Ed Miliband.
Oh, no.
I felt like I was
Are you sure that's not UBI?
She says, I felt like I was in a surreal episode of Cheerful Podcast. Maybe I could be Minister for Bladder Infections under Jeff Lloyd's benign dictatorship.
I mean, I can only apologise. That must be really disturbing.
But are you available for medical consultations if people are in a pinch?
I mean, I think I'm available, but I don't think it's advisable. Do you know what I mean? It's like,
all right.
You know,
what about,
it's
what
like
about
Donald
UV-
Trump and hydrochloroxine or whatever it's called.
Reasons to be cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Well, here we are in the outro.
And I think you've got some sort of, what do they call it? You've got some topiary, is that right?
So I had a beard trimming accident this week. Usually, under normal circumstances, I would go to the barber to get my beard trimmed. So I've not used an electric beard trimmer in years, and I don't really know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
But I ordered one online, and I trimmed my beard the other night, and it just went very badly wrong very quickly. It was bushy on one side, it was almost, you know, bare on the other side. I walked in to show my wife and she was horrified by what had done to myself. She tried to then, you know, she tried to dig herself out of the hole by going, no, it looks fine. Sorry, I was just distracted when you came in. But, you know, we can just see on somebody's face, she's thinking, what have I done? How can I be expected to look at that until the beard grows back? So she said, why don't you trim it into a mustache? Which I did, but that didn't go very well either. I think it looks like, do you remember after the Brexit referendum, Nigel Farage grew a moustache?
No, I don't.
It's almost as unimpressive as that.
But, you know, the funny thing is that when you sent it to me, I was absolutely gobsmacked and thought you looked totally different. But I'm wondering now whether that was just an illusion of it being sent to me in black and white and you looking and having a sort of sad face on.
Well, it's starting to grow back as well. I think what you're probably responding to is that without any kind of stubble or beard, my face just sort of blends into my neck. I've just got this sort of one big blob of a head and neck. But at least there's a bit of an outline.
You are being quite hard on yourself, actually.
It wasn't.
I think you look lovely anyway you are.
Have you ever experimented with facial hair?
Yes. Remember, was it famously? Well, obviously not that famously.
Oh, of course, yes.
After the 2015 general election, yeah.
Yeah, the breakdown look.
Discovered in Australia with a beard.
Yes.
Yeah. And then, actually, soon after that, beards became very fashionable.
And you credit yourself.
Well, I don't really know. I think I was at the crest.
That's for other people to do.
I was at the crest of the wave.
Yeah. Beard.
Peak beard. Well,
shall we thank our guests?
Let's do that. I'd like to thank David Woolner, Anna Smee, Kathleen Hennahan, and Martin Moore.
And Emma Caution produces our podcast. I want to salute Emma in particular this week because she has to take Ed's recordings, which have been fraught with difficulties.
You're
really struggling with the equipment.
I'm almost
thinking that maybe a good idea would be for Emma to turn up at your house every week and push a microphone through the letterbox and then at the end of every recording retrieve it and take it home herself rather than deal with what she's been dealing with you.
Well, I think there's also you've been having to deal with it too, so I do apologise.
Oh, it's fine for me. I just have to sit here while you flap. But that's you've done that with me plenty of times in the past. But thank you to Emma and, of course, to Joel Pierce, who researches all the stuff for the podcast, with backup from Joe Kenyon and Zoe Gelber. Gail Lofthouse is our announcer. James Deacon made the idents. Ed Seed composed the music. And the artwork was designed by
Henry Cole.
He's been Bob Filling.
He's been Jonathan McCavity.
And these have been
Reasons to be Cheerful.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.